We need to help children create space within themselves for these feelings because they're powerful. And if we don't learn how to wield them as youngsters, then we are at risk.
Family life is essential. Jim and I are on a mission to help you live the best one. You'll hear personal stories from thought leaders of strengths and struggles with proven strategies to help you make the most of your 18 summers. I'm your co-host, Jamie Shields. Hey, 18 Summers Tribe. Today, we're speaking with Dr. Sherry Walling. Sherry is a friend of ours for a few years now. She is a clinical psychologist, speaker, podcaster, author, and mental health advocate. She helped us navigate through some waters in our blended family, and she just recently published a book, her second book, Touching Two Worlds. It's a poetic, incisive exploration of grief and joy in the aftermath of loss. She shares a bit of her story with us in this podcast, as well as some guidelines, tools, thoughts on how to communicate grief alongside your children and your spouse, how to play in the face of grief, and how to have joy alongside of grief. It's a good one. It's a quick one. It's powerful. And I hope you enjoy.
I am really delighted to have a conversation with the two of you. Thanks for inviting me. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. And actually, I think when we started talking about having you on, we didn't even realize how soon or recently your book would be releasing. And so this happens to be during all good of your timing. Traction for the release of the book and your book tour that you've been doing unconditionally.
With unconditional love and unconventional means. Yes, it's both. It both works.
Have you been having a lot of fun?
I have been really grateful to have the right amount of support and great cheerleaders. You know, I wrote a very heavy book. This book is about death. It's about the death of my dad to cancer and brother to suicide. It's about grief. So it is a thing to tackle. And I'm really aware of that as I'm engaging with people who are reading it or thinking about reading it. But one of the ways that has been available to me to kind of engage this story has been through movement and circus arts and integrating performance into conversations around death and grief, which when I originally told my publisher, like, we're going to launch the book and I want to launch the book with an original circus show about suicide, they kind of flipped their lids. And I was like, trust me, it'll be fine. So anyway, all that to say, it's been very unconventional, but I think has presented a lot of beautiful and unusual entry points into some really hard conversations in a way that's a little bit more accessible than it may be otherwise.
I love that. And that was, you know, my initial thought of you are, it does appear that you're having fun on your book tour, and yet your book is so heavy. And so I love that you, or that it's on a heavy topic. Let me take that back, because it's so beautifully and gently written. The book itself is not heavy, but you are covering just deeply meaningful topics. And to take something so playful and beautiful and artistic to communicate those feelings that you're having and to experience life almost does make it fun. And you have a saying, play is the antidote of grief. Is that what it is?
Yeah. Play is the antidote to grief.
Yeah.
The title Touching Two Worlds kind of comes from that feeling, that sense of, on one hand, finding myself in a place in my life where I needed to be really present and in some ways fully immersed in death and illness and grief and sort of things falling apart and holding a lot of pain. But then in the other side, at the same time, I'm also in a place in my life where I'm raising children, I'm growing a career, I'm growing as an artist. Like, there's so much like joy and generativity and creativity in my life. And so the Touching Two Worlds idea is like, how do you go back and forth between both and be fully in grief? Like, no apologies. I'm not afraid to be there. I need to be there sometimes, but then also know that I have this sort of passport to joy and that that is okay to sit alongside the experience of grief. So integrating this circus and these all of these pieces into the conversation about the book feels very representative of that message to me. So it feels like very in integrity with how I believe humans can walk through grief without losing their sense of play and joy.
That's great. Mm-hmm. And for, I want to make sure, because it is so powerful and we know, but the audience doesn't know. And I know you kind of hit on it. Like, would you give a little backstory just about what you've been through? I mean,
yeah,
the timing and all that. I just think there's so much power in that.
Yeah. So my dad at age 65 was diagnosed with esophageal cancer and was stage 4, quite advanced, and had about 18 months between his diagnosis and his death. And during that time, he was all in on fighting this cancer and on trying to be one of the exceptional people who would have a successful outcome after this diagnosis. And of course, you know, that wasn't how the story went. He did die. And right alongside his illness and death, my brother, who was 32 at the time, had some struggles with alcohol and depression. Like, some things were sort of unsettled within him. But my dad's illness really created some storm such that he did this really deep dive into his own illness right alongside that journey. So both of them kind of unwound. And my dad died in November, and then my brother died by suicide exactly 6 months after my dad's death.
Wow.
So yeah, it was quite an immersion into watching these people I really loved falling apart and then ultimately their lives ending.
And how do you communicate this? You know, as you mentioned earlier, the play, you know, you can have joy right next to grief, and you can be fully immersed in one or the other at any moment. And it doesn't mean because you're joyful that you're not grieving, or because you're grieving that you can't have joy. How do you express these huge concepts? You know, how do you go from, I'm in deep grief right now, but I do have to function, I do have to live in these mm-hmm. two worlds. How much of that do you communicate to your children? And how much of that do you communicate with your spouse?
I think it began for me in my relationship with my brother and my dad. So my dad sent a text one day that was like, I've lost my eyelashes. And it was one of those moments that was like, insult to injury. Like, it's a small thing in the scheme of like cancer and chemo and that journey, but it was like one of those moments of like, oh my God, I can't believe I've lost my eyelashes. So I was like, I got you, Dad. So I get on Amazon and I send him this like box of like garish, terrible, like strip or like glue on eyelashes with the glitter and the stones and the whole thing. And I think it was one of those moments where it felt like we can crumble or we can laugh. It's going to hurt either way.
Yep.
But that like really well-placed levity was important in keeping us connected, if nothing else. And there were some stories like that with my brother too. But I think in my conversations with my kids, part of the honesty of this was for them to see me in grief, right? To not hide from them. I couldn't really, just to be honest, like I don't have that kind of stone wall. But for them to see my grief, I think also allowed them to really notice when I felt very joyful. Mm-hmm. So when you are in grief, I think it can feel very cold and it can feel pretty scary for kids, right? Like, my mom is really sad. My mom is sad because her dad died. Like, my mom's gonna die. Like, kids sort of weave this through line that can feel very scary. And so talking really openly about death, holding them really close to my body and being like, can you hear my heartbeat? I'm alive. Like, do you feel my aliveness? Like, you can rest in that. You can trust that right now. Anyway, those kinds of experiences of really counterbalancing openness about sadness and loss with deep aliveness and deep play was really important. And also, my kids at this time were 8, 8, and 12. So they're like in the prime of like play, like they're good at playing. They're up for it. So I think they were in many ways like, okay, it's really sad, but you want to go out and throw the Frisbee? You know, like they can transition quickly. And so we just transitioned in and out of these feelings together.
Yeah. Which was a harder one for your kids, your dad or your brother?
I don't know, harder. They were different. I mean, they had deep relationships with both of them. My brother was probably the family member that they know the best. We don't live in the same state as our family, but when my brother got sick, he came to where I live in Minneapolis to go to treatment. And so he was nearby a lot and they knew him quite well. But I think losing a grandpa, it's hard to say.
Yeah.
One thing that was different, I think, for all of us is that when my dad died, we knew that was going to happen. And so there was lots of conversation. I was present with him when he died. There were moments of goodbye that each of the kids made. And so it had an element of participation and sure. potentially some closure. My brother died far away. He died in Montana. He died without anyone near him. And he died suddenly. You know, we knew he was sick, but suicide is always, I think, no matter how many risk factors exist, it's always a shock. Yeah. So I think that was this shock to the system where we didn't quite have this level of preparation and goodbye that was important for all of us with my dad's loss.
I think that's an important thing that you mentioned, that as your dad was declining, you didn't try to hide it or make, you know, you just very much like, this is death and this is a part of it. And we've had a number, now we've gone through two or three
your grandmother, my father
visits where we've brought somebody home to pass and we watch the progression and we sleep in the room with them and we throw parties around them. And it's just a very normal and natural thing if you allow it to be, right?
Yeah.
And I remember the first time we did, when my grandmother came in, like even the neighborhood kids wanted to come over and watch her dying. And I know that sounds different, but it really is very normal. And I think, you know, to act as though it's nothing is not a thing. And to act as though it's, you know, the end and horribly traumatic isn't always the right way either. And so, you know, I love that you've given a perspective of, you know, you had two types of this experience, two very different feelings, and yet they all are grief. You can be sad even if it was closed, or, you know, closure and your family was prepared, and you can be sad even though it's traumatic. You know, and this brings me to kind of in a roundabout way. You referenced recently, you wrote a great post about Disney movies and about how, you know, we watch movies. This is not it, I'm paraphrasing, but the way my mind went to it was, we use the television to babysit our children. And then there's these big death scenes and that's it. Like, oh, Simba's dad died. And now we move on to the next screen, you know, and there's no process. I do believe Simba grieved, you know, for a split second, but there's no discussion. Parents, you know, I don't know how many times my children have watched something and I've not paused to have a communication about it. Can you talk a little bit about how we can take these opportunities to communicate grief or make the most of these moments?
I feel like even to your earlier point, Jamie, like we're so separate from death. Like I think this is sort of the first time in the human experience where you wouldn't be in a home or in a larger compound where you'd have grandparents or great aunts dying and you'd be around that. Sort of similar to birth, like it happens somewhere else in a hospital, like it's anesthetized, you're separate from it. But, you know, 40 years ago, 100 years ago, 200 years ago, you'd be kind of right in it, even as a child, in ways where it wouldn't feel so foreign. But in lieu of those experiences of birth and death within just family life, we have stories that we hold. And so many, many stories, like the vast majority of stories that are part of films aimed towards children, have an element of death. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's just a device to explain why some kid is out like in the forest by themselves for an extended period of time to have the adventure. But death is a really important part of a lot of plots for children. And I don't think that's terrible. I think children are often worried about death. They're aware of death. They're looking to like sort of wrap their mind around what death is and what happens. So when stories depict that a child is still thriving and having adventures and finding friends after death, like there's positive in that. But one of my big critiques, as you're alluding to, is the sense that there's no very little depiction of grief, right? It's basically like somebody dies. Maybe there's a scene where the hero is like standing over the casket as it's being dropped into the ground. And then they're like off. They're off to fight the robot, reclaim the kingdom, save the world, whatever it is. And there's no emotional space. And what I worry about is that teaches kids from a young age this expectation that I've seen integrated into every level of our society, from our entrepreneur friends to our, you know, our working moms to everybody, is this sense that like somebody dies, you have the service on a Saturday and you're back to the office by Tuesday and you don't want to let it overtake you. You don't want to stop too long. You don't want to grieve. You need to keep moving. And that is what these movies are showing our kids. And so if anything, I think there's this invitation to pause the film and just say, you know, realistically, like, what do you think happens after your mom dies or your sibling dies? What do you think people feel? What do you think is helpful to them? Because this story is condensing the time, right? It's sort of skipping over this grief part. But what do you think grief looks like for this character in this scenario? And just have a conversation about what I would call grief literacy. You know, we need to help children create space within themselves for these feelings because they're powerful. And if we don't sort of learn how to wield them as youngsters, then I think we are at risk for something like what my brother experienced, where grief really exacerbated his vulnerability in a way that became very sort of deadly for him. So that was a very long answer to your question, but I just feel like these grief conversations are essential in helping our kids be able to navigate the things that are inevitably going to happen in their lives when they experience loss.
Yeah.
How dangerous are the words to your children? It's okay. You know, like, is that a comfort or is that a, you know, I'm thinking we were listening to an audiobook.
Maybe not. It's okay. You're okay.
You're okay.
You know,
I'm just thinking of this as you're talking about the emotional literacy, the grief literacy. And we've been enjoying a series of books that I think that the children of, or the younger children are old enough to listen to now. And there's a lot of battle and there's a lot of like, even though they're animals, they're like cockroaches and bats. But these are characters that our children have come to identify with. And when they pass in a battle, even if it's a valiant, you know, death, it's like, it's sad. I remember Sammy, the cockroach died and Sammy was like, oh, mommy, he's dead. And I'm wondering, as you're talking, I'm thinking, did I say, oh, it's okay, Sammy? Like, I don't know how I address that, you know? And I'm thinking, wow, I hope I didn't just say, it's okay, and then move on, because it's not okay. He was sad.
Yeah. There's so much both and in parenting, right? I do feel like it's really important to give that space to, it is really sad that that character died. And I bet all of his friends are sad and everyone that loves him is sad. And we can have a moment for sad. Would you like to draw a picture of Sammy? Would you like to, you know, name one of the trees in the yard after Sammy? Like, I think there's this really simple combination of express and then act, take a meaningful action in memory of the one that's been lost. But sometimes in certain situations, the you're okay is a really wonderful assurance to children. And I, you know, there's probably lots of different ways to frame it, but one of the ways that I like to frame it is to say something like, everything you need for this is already inside of you. Which is a complicated way of saying you're okay, but it's my belief to my kids, like, ooh, this is hard and it's really painful. And I believe from my toes to the top of my head that you're up for it, that you have what you need inside of you.
Oh,
I love that.
What have the, do the kids understand about mom's launched this big book and it's talking about like the family pain, and what did they think about it? I mean, cause you know, we write family books and
there
can be some uncomfortable stuff.
And surprisingly, oh, totally.
Yeah. Well, we've had deep conversations about this. How did your husband and your family react to sharing such vulnerability?
My mother and my surviving brother and my husband all read the book before it went out to an agent. You know, that was obviously important buy-in and like sign off. So they knew about what was going to be written and supported me in that. Since the book has been published, my children have both read it and listened to me read it at a reading and listened to the audiobook. So I'm like, okay, guys, we're like, you know, we're diving in here. They have treated it with such tenderness. They're older now. I mean, they're 16 and 12. So they have some capacity to, I think, absorb the nuances of it.
Sure.
It certainly filled in a lot of details they didn't know. And so I've kind of done a lot of like, hey, can, you know, do you want to talk? Do you have any questions? And they haven't really had questions, but I will say they've held it with such tenderness that I've really felt us becoming closer in, you know, them seeing me as more human and more of a being that has emotions that maybe don't have to do with them, which is developmentally appropriate, right? A 6-year-old wouldn't read this book, but my 16-year-old can read this book. So it's kind of an honor to share it with them. And if I'm honest, it's probably for them that I wrote it. I wanted them to know these stories, and I wanted them to have some sense of grief so that they would know how to walk through it, or at least have some ideas for when they have to grieve.
That makes a lot of sense. Makes a lot of sense. And that's the way you want it to be, right? I mean, it's so much more supportive and endearing when your family is behind you on that. So
yeah,
I was curious because you're in the same realm as us. And I don't think I would have the drive if they weren't like, no, this is really good. You know, that is a nice reassurance to have. But I think when you're coming at it with such vulnerability and such authenticity, it'd be tough for them not to support it. Just my thought, but it'd be really hard.
I think if I wrote like a how to parent through grief manual, they would probably have lots of things to say, right? They'd be like, no, not that one. You didn't do that. You know, like then they become the critic. But when you're so open-hearted and like, this is my story and this is how I felt, I think it's hard even for your teenagers to get too snarky.
How has this process been for you? I know this journey started together. We were at the same writing course class together. And I remember hearing your story first then. And you've just, has it been an evolution of soul, you know, to go from feeling these words to writing these words, to sharing these words, to having your children read these words? I mean, do you feel like a different person from when this started?
I feel like there's a beautiful progression that's happened in going from being a writer to an author, or in going from having a story to sharing a story as broadly as possible. So I guess maybe another way to say it is that these stories were mine. They happened to me. These thoughts and feelings and words are mine. But in publishing the book, I'm giving them. They aren't mine anymore, because everyone who reads the book has their own interaction with it, relationship with it, and then it's theirs, right? It becomes part of their story. So I'm really like grateful and humble, gonna get all teary, that this story has meaning for someone else, because it was very meaningful to me, but that doesn't necessarily mean that will matter to anybody else. So the fact that it has landed in a way that I believe really does serve people is, I mean, it's sort of the greatest expression of who I am as a writer and as a psychologist. I mean, that's my work in the world. So I don't know that I feel like a totally different person, but I know that I'm just grateful to be in this moment with this book.
Wonderful. I think it's probably a beautiful becoming of just taking what you had been given and then giving it as a gift to others. So
yeah,
that's beautiful. Thank you for sharing. Where can our listeners learn more about you before Jim asks his final question?
Yeah, the more of the sort of story of the book is at touchingtwoworlds.com. So if people are curious about that, I'm also on Instagram and Twitter as @SherryWalling. So that's a good spot to keep up with all of my shenanigans.
Wonderful.
Well, our finale question, Sherry, we started asking this a few years ago, I think the beginning of the pandemic. And it was, you know, we all say, what would you say to 21-year-old Sherry? And that's good. You learned something of it. But we were saying, now I need something deeper and wiser for, you know, all the craziness we were all going through. So we said, I wonder what my 75-year-old self would say to me right now. What wisdom would they impart to me right now? And so we started to ask a lot of people and started to really get some fascinating answers. So, you know, what advice do you think, you know, so we're looking way down the road, but, you know, what advice do you think 75-year-old Sherry would give to you and the rest of us?
I feel like she would say to me, keep going, like keep at it. You've found this place where you're making meaning out of painful things, and the world needs that sauce.
That's great.
So I think she's already cheering for me, cheering for this work.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for sharing it with the world and for being vulnerable enough to take that pain and create it into a purpose for all of us.
Yeah. Thanks so much for the conversation, the two of you. It's lovely.
Yeah. It's always good to see you, and we'll look forward to having more.
That'd be great. Take good care.
Take care, Sherry.
Thanks for joining the 18 Summers podcast and putting your family in priority position. Subscribe and leave a review and help other families just like you.